From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Hello and welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Kim Lewis, and joining me on the panel this week are VOA senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain and columnist for Newsday, Dan Raviv. Welcome, Cindy and Dan.
Thank you.
Good to be with you, Kim.
Well, here are the issues. Russia launched an attack on Ukraine early Thursday with President Vladimir Putin warning other countries not to intervene and Ukraine's Western allies pledging their support and new rounds of strong sanctions as they condemned the Russian assault. Putin used a televised address to announce the start of a military operation in eastern Ukraine in response to what he called Ukrainian threats. Reaction from across the globe was swift. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky cut all ties with Moscow and within a short time issued martial law across the nation, urging Ukrainians to defend their country. President Joe Biden called the attack unprovoked and vowed to hold Moscow accountable for the invasion. And at an emergency session of the United Nations Security Council, U.S. Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield said the invasion was a grave emergency and the council will need to act. The Supreme Court turned away an appeal by former President Donald Trump in his dispute with congressional investigators who have sought access to Trump-era records as part of the House of Representatives Select Panel's investigation into the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol. The development formally ends Trump's legal effort to block lawmakers' efforts to obtain batches of schedules, call logs, emails, and other requested documents that the investigating committee says could illuminate key circumstances surrounding the deadly Capitol riot. Reports of a possible convoy of truckers protesting vaccination mandates in the coming days prompted the Defense Department to approve the use of 700 National Guardsmen and 50 tactical vehicles before they descend on the Washington, D.C. area. And a jury in the U.S. state of Georgia found the three white men who killed Ahmaud Arbery, a 25-year-old black man, guilty on all counts in the federal hate crimes trial. Travis McMichael, Gregory McMichael, and William Roddy Bryan were each charged in federal court with interference with rights, a hate crime, and attempted kidnapping. Well, those are the issues, and let's get started. Well, Cindy, the U.S. government is reacting to the Russian invasion of Ukraine, vowing that Moscow will be held accountable. So what are the latest developments you have on this crisis situation?
Well, that's right, Kim. It's just hard to overstate what a cataclysmic blow this is, not only, of course, first and foremost, for the people of Ukraine who are under attack, a full-scale invasion from all sides, multiple cities being attacked, but also for Europe, with the NATO Secretary General Stoltenberg saying that the post-World War II decades of peace have been shattered by Russia, but also for the United States and for the world. As we all know, Russia is a nuclear superpower. So this is very, very frightening territory because Ukraine is not a member of NATO and it doesn't benefit from this mutual defense pact, but several of its neighbors are. And the U.S. is saying that it's going to bolster its eastern flanks, moving U.S. and NATO troops around to make it very clear to Putin that you need to stop this. International condemnation has been raining down on Putin, with the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz calling on him to stop this military assault. As you said, President Biden saying this was a premeditated war, a needless war, and war of choice. So this is a very, very serious moment that we're in now.
Cindy, Thursday morning really was shocking as the Russians rolled into Ukraine and struck targets, notably airports, we saw in the first hours. But on the other hand, why were we shocked? Because the United States and other countries had been warning for weeks that this was Vladimir Putin's plan, and then he did it. I think the big question that I was hearing here in Washington was, what good did the sanctions do, or the threat of sanctions? Even though the Biden administration is saying it's terrific that the NATO alliance has been more united than it's been for years and we're standing together, that did not stop the Russians. I think the strongest point I heard from Secretary of State Antony Blinken was that the U.S. and its allies, by actually moving more forces into countries near Russia, would be teaching Putin a lesson. He didn't want NATO forces to be closer to Russia. Now, as a result of his action, NATO forces are closer to Russia. And then, in addition, there was the plan to send a lot of aid to any pro-freedom forces in Ukraine that will be fighting the Russians. This could be really messy. I really doubt it's going to look like a victory for the NATO alliance, because it couldn't stop the Russians from doing this. Of course, I'm not at all sure this will turn out to be a victory for Putin and the Russians.
Yeah, I think you're right, Dan. I mean, short of sending troops into Ukraine, which President Biden has said he would not do, so there would not be like a hot war between nuclear powers, the toolkit of the U.S. and the West was limited. And as you say, the U.S. had been predicting this. It seemed like they were just revealing intelligence and just getting a step ahead out of Putin every single time, saying he's going to, you know, stage fake attacks as a pretext for war. He's going to say, you know, ethnic Russians in the eastern part of Ukraine are under threat. And it played out exactly as the United States said it would. Unfortunately, I think the U.S. officials would very happily have been wrong about the way that this has played out so far. But the toolkit is limited, and now the West has to see how to respond to try to bring this war to an end as quickly as possible, to cut Russia off from the Western financial system and also make it harder for them to get exports of parts that they need for computers and things like that. So this is a difficult situation. So far, the U.S. and NATO and the European allies have all been united.
Here within the United States, not so much unity. The Democratic Party wants to stand with its President Joe Biden in saying that he's done the right thing and they're going to support whatever moves he does, unprecedented sanctions against Putin and Russia. The Republican Party seems divided. The former President Donald Trump put out statements that say that Putin is savvy, that he's smart, that rolling in the tanks to Ukraine was very impressive. There was no protest in these early messages from former President Trump. He seemed to be impressed by what Vladimir Putin had done. On the other hand, there are more old-fashioned Republicans who say that the U.S. needs to be stronger in stopping the Russians. So I think there's an interesting division within the Republican Party right now over this.
Given the situation with the U.S. giving us the warnings, did the U.S. and its allies, did they underestimate Putin? Did they really think there was a diplomatic resolution before the invasion?
I don't think they underestimated him. I mean, the State Department spokesperson Ned Price was facing some questions because he mentioned something about kabuki theater of the Russians, you know, having these diplomatic meetings. And he was asked, well, do you mean that all of these meetings, your meetings with the Russian foreign minister Lavrov in Geneva, that all this was just theater? And this, of course, you know, we'll have to go back and look at some of this. But I think it was a genuine and important attempt by the West and by France and Germany and the United States and others to deter Putin. But obviously, he had this plan. And whether it's energy or whether it's his own version of history, false version, where Ukraine was not an independent country since 1991, but always a part of Mother Russia, or whatever it is, Putin seemed determined. But I think that the United States got it exactly right, said that he would start with an air campaign. It's almost chilling how correct that they were about what he was going to do.
I agree, Cindy. I think U.S. officials were right about what Putin would do. But you always have to offer what diplomats call an off-ramp, a route that Putin could take or could have taken to avoid war. But we don't know what the West was offering him. I think Putin's basic demand was that Ukraine never, ever join the Western Defense Alliance, NATO. And he also wants to keep Ukraine out of the European Union. To Putin's view, Ukraine is not a legitimate country. It's just a buffer between Russia and the West. There's no indication from the West that Western countries were offering concessions on that, but call it a matter of principle. The American president, Joe Biden, said that the Ukrainian people have a right to decide their own future. And so NATO was not going to rule out that Ukraine might be a member one day. Putin, at least in the legend that he was telling the world, says that was an act of aggression against Russia, holding the possibility Ukraine might one day be part of the Western alliance.
Right. I don't believe, Dan, that Putin was looking for an off-ramp at all. And in the hours before the Thursday invasion, Ukraine's President Zelensky tried urgently to call Russian President Putin. Putin would not take his call. And what I'm hearing from Russian experts is that Putin does not view Zelensky as a legitimate president. He's talking about the now doing the denazification of Ukraine and what he, you know, he considers that Zelensky and his whole government were, you know, it was a popular movement that brought them in. But Putin basically says this is illegitimate. So I don't think he views the current government. I think he does want regime change. I don't think he views the current government in Ukraine as legitimate, but the rest of the world does. And I don't believe that there was any off-ramp.
By that reading, Putin really fears the pro-democracy movements in Ukraine, before that in Georgia, in other places that had been part of the old Soviet Union. And I guess Putin fears that there could be street protests in Russia one day aimed against him. So he wants to quash any government, any regime that's the result of a pro-democracy movement. Certainly Ukraine is a shining example of that.
Right, yes.
And also Ukrainian President Zelensky, he urged Ukrainians to defend their country. So the Ukrainians are definitely going to fight for their country and to try to defend it.
Yes, I think they will. And I think if it were just the Russian army against the Ukrainian army, we would see quite a fair fight. But the problem is that Russia has so much of a superior air force. Ukraine does not have much of an air force or much in the way of air defenses. And I think this is just why Ukraine is outmatched.
In the first hours of the big invasion on Thursday, we certainly wondered whether Russia will try to occupy the cities of Ukraine, including the capital, Kyiv, or Russia will just try to control military targets around the edges. Because, as you said, occupying a big country like Ukraine, that's going to be deeply troublesome for Russia if they try.
I just wanted to mention one other aspect of this. A suspected cyber attack shut down a handful of Ukraine's government websites also on Wednesday. So, of course, is this part of Russia's tactics? And what are U.S. officials doing about this with the concern of that happening here in the U.S.?
Well, I heard from U.S. officials who are involved in cyber defenses that they were fully expecting big attacks from Russian hackers, in this case, Russian government hackers, that could be aimed at utility companies, gas supplies, for instance, not just in the United States, but in other Western countries, if only so that Russia could show, you know, the damage that it's able to cause. And so I'd say the cyber defenses were raised here in the West. It was expected Russia would make that part of the attack.
Okay, we'll have to move along. Looking on Capitol Hill, the Supreme Court denied former President Donald Trump's emergency request to block the transfer of his White House records from the National Archives to the House Select Committee. So what is the next step for Trump and for the investigating committee?
Well, as for the committee, it's looking into the events of January 6th last year when there was an invasion of the U.S. Capitol building by pro-Trump protesters who wanted to stop the official counting of the election votes. They claimed that the election had been stolen from Trump, and the then president absolutely encouraged them. Now you have an investigation by a House of Representatives committee as to what happened. Almost all Republicans are rejecting the mission of that committee, as you're saying. Trump didn't want to cooperate in any way at all. So the committee eventually put out a report. They'll probably have public hearings with some witnesses, but Republicans in general are going to keep rejecting the findings of the committee. And keep in mind, just 1 year ago, Donald Trump was impeached by the House of Representatives for a second time, first time that ever happened with an American president, and specifically for inciting the insurrection of January 6th. So there are a lot of people who feel that Trump was already punished. So what's the point? Whereas others say the investigation has to at least tell the public what really happened that day.
Yeah, there certainly are a lot of people who want to know. The basic question is, did former President Trump order this attack on our nation's capital and this attempt to stop the peaceful transfer of power in the United States? Inside Congress that day, they were certifying Joe Biden as the legitimately elected president of the United States. So that's what it's about. And that's why the committee is trying to get the records of who Trump was speaking with, what he was talking about, what he was doing, call logs and documents and everything from that day. Unfortunately, there are holes in the records because apparently Trump was using other people's phones. But the committee is determined to get down to the bottom of who actually funded and ordered this orchestrated attack on the U.S. Capitol and on the peaceful transfer of power.
And also, while the committee has not established a hard deadline for completing its investigation, their chairperson, Benny Thompson, said the panel hopes to wrap up by early spring. So I guess they're trying to get this particular investigation done, it looks like, before the midterm elections in November.
Yes, obviously, it's going to be a big political issue. But again, keep in mind, Republicans who are loyal to former President Trump will keep rejecting what the congressional committee is doing, and Trump himself says it's part of a witch hunt.
Well, on that note, we will take a quick break. And when we return, Washington, D.C. prepares for a possible convoy of truckers. Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype, VOA Senior Diplomatic Correspondent Cindy Sain and columnist for Newsday Dan Revive. Well, a bridge connecting Detroit and Ontario, Canada has officially reopened, ending a nearly week-long standoff between police and truck drivers protesting COVID-19 vaccine mandates required to cross the U.S.-Canadian border. But U.S. officials are warning that the protests could now spread out across the U.S., including in Washington, D.C., prompting the Defense Department to approve the use of 700 National Guardsmen and 50 tactical vehicles before they descend on Washington, D.C. So does the Biden administration anticipate these demonstrations coming into Washington, D.C.?
It looks like the government felt that the truckers, inspired by what happened in Canada's capital, Ottawa, would be heading here to Washington, could cause some traffic disruption. Certainly, security measures around the Capitol building were increased for the coming days, perhaps the coming weeks. It's hard to know if this kind of partially organized campaign would be timed for any particular event. For instance, this coming week, Joe Biden delivers the annual State of the Union address at the U.S. Capitol. So, yeah, I noticed that security concerns increased here.
Yes, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi was asked if she felt like that the Capitol was secure after what happened on January 6th of last year. And she said, yes, that the Capitol is secure. As to whether extensive fencing would be put up again to protect the president and lawmakers during the State of the Union speech, she said that the Capitol Police would decide that. But what we know is that the people participating in this convoy and organizing it have links to far-right organizations. They have a lot of connections to the same people who were involved in the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. And ostensibly, they are protesting COVID-19 mandates. But as COVID numbers have thankfully decreased, they're really, a lot of these mandates have already been lifted. So some would say this is sort of a protest without a cause. And there was one particular trucker in Pennsylvania who had promised to choke Washington, D.C. like a boa constrictor. But then when he tried to leave this week, there was basically only one truck So it's hard to see now, you know, how this will develop, whether it will get bigger. They had some trouble getting started. Some said it looked more like less like a spontaneous grassroots protest and more like an organized thing.
The organizers are calling it the People's Convoy, saying that they want to jumpstart the economy and reopen the country. And as you both have pointed out, there's been mixed reaction to this convoy. However, some supporters of it are saying that they have a right to protest just as others do.
I see the connection with the COVID-19 pandemic and the sense across the United States that the Omicron phase is over. So the number of cases is down. And therefore, the leaders of many states, including governors who are in the Democratic Party, eliminated many of the mandatory measures, such as wearing masks in public places or indoors. You know, it depended on each state. And so the protesters seem to be saying, we never wanted any of these requirements at all. It was all a mistake. And in general, they are political conservatives, so they're blaming liberals for having been too tough during the pandemic in the past 2 years. And the conservatives claim it didn't do any good.
So we will just have to see the developments in the coming days. And as we know that Washington, D.C. is preparing in the event there is a trucker convoy coming to the nation's capital. Moving on to our last topic, a jury in Brunswick, Georgia found defendants Travis McMichael, his father Greg McMichael, and their neighbor William Bryan guilty on all counts in a federal hate crimes trial. All three men were convicted of murdering Ahmaud Arbery in a state trial last year and sentenced to life in prison. Looking at this particular hate crimes verdict, how significant was it?
I thought the reaction across the nation was fascinating. Americans really cared whether these three men would be found guilty of hate crimes, and they were, which means that they used force, threats of force, chased him down a public street, tried to deny him his rights because of their hatred for black people. And so those are federal crimes in the National Crime Registry here. And in fact, they were convicted of those hate crimes and will be serving time in prison. Yes, even life sentences because a man was killed as a result of a hate crime. But keep in mind that just in January, a state court had found them guilty in a more ordinary murder trial. And there, too, they were given life sentences, with one man having the possibility of getting out on parole in 30 years. But that wasn't enough. It was important to Arbery's family. It was important to the public, not only in the state of Georgia. And so I thought many lessons were learned on how racial hatred can lead to murder and great divisiveness in this country.
Yes, I think that Dan is right. And one assistant U.S. attorney said that the three defendants did not see Mr. Arbery as a human being. And they did hunt him down and murder him because he was black. And I think that was very important, as Dan said, to his family and to others, that this was established in this federal trial. And some are saying that this is an important lesson, that prosecutors should be a bit bolder and a bit more courageous about putting people on trial for hate crimes. You know, sometimes they're reluctant because they say it's hard to prove somebody's motives. But in this case, the motivation was well documented with all three of the defendants publicly and privately writing and saying, you know, racial slurs and inflammatory comments. And prosecutors should try to use this tool of federal hate crimes more often.
Yes, and that really brings me up to the last question I was going to throw out there. To get a conviction on this hate crimes charge, federal prosecutors were tasked with proving to the jury that the defendants targeted Arbery because he was black. But defense attorneys argued that their clients had legitimate reasons to pursue him. They maintained that the defendants recognized him as the same man seen on surveillance cameras inside a home construction site at night. But with this conviction of a hate crime, can you say this was a test for racial justice?
It's a test of what's acceptable, among other things. If you think that there is some burglar running through your neighborhood, you call the police. You don't get on your truck, grab a rifle, get in a tussle with him and kill him. And then, as we said, it's discovered about these three men that they were racists, that they had terrible views about black people. So, yeah, I'm actually glad that in public, their hateful views have been rejected.
And also, I'd like to point out that February 23rd is now officially known as Ahmaud Arbery Day in the state of Georgia. And that's all the time we have. My thanks go to our panelists, VOA senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain and columnist for Newsday, Dan Raviv. I'm Kim Lewis. Join us again for Issues in the News.